Ray Brinkman and Dorothy Cazalli. They're not hard to find. Two people for whom trees mean almost nothing. Two people who, even in the spring of their lives, can't tell an oak from a linden. Two people who have never given woods a second thought until an entire forest marches for miles across the stage of a tiny black box theater in downtown St. Paul, 1974. Ray Brinkman, junior intellectual property lawyer. Dorothy Cazalli, stenographer for a company that does work for his firm. He can't stop watching her as she takes depositions. The silent, fluid beauty of her manual ballet boggles him. A passionata sonata slewing out of her miming fingers. She catches him gazing and dares him with a glance to own up. He does. It's easier than dying from acute, distant admiration. She agrees to go out with him if she can pick the venue. He signs off on the deal, never imagining the hidden clauses. She picks an audition for an amateur production of Macbeth. Why? She says, no reason. A lark, a whim, freedom. But there is, of course, no freedom. There are only ancient prophecies that scry the seeds of time and say which will grow and which will not. For amateur production, read terrifying. The audition is like monster hunting without a flashlight. Neither has been in a play since high school. But they screw their courage to the sticking place, and both end up squeezing a blackly masochistic white-knuckle fun out of the evening. Whoa, he says, walking her from the hall. What in the world was that? I've always wanted to pretend I could act. I just needed an accomplice. So, what do we do for an encore? You pick. How about something a little less nerve-crushing next time? Ever gone cliff diving? Here's the thing. They both get cast. Of course they get cast. They were cast already before they tried out. That's how myths work. Macduff and Lady Macbeth. Ray calls up Dorothy in a total panic, like he's been playing with his father's shotgun and it just went off. We don't actually have to take the parts, right? It's community theater. I think they're counting on you. She knows already the precise worst button she can press in him, right there in their first week together. Criminally responsible, this man. Pathologically accountable to the hopes and expectations of his kind. And the lady? Reckless enough for 10 of him. She pretty much tells him, no Macbeth, no more dates. They take the parts. Dorothy is a natural. But Ray, even the casting director the night of the first read-through, thinks she may have made a terrible mistake. Dorothy watches the man, awed. He's the best, worst actor she has ever seen. He just speaks his lines, with a lanky gall and astonishing naivete, as if he's putting forward the case for his own existence in front of the end-of-time debate club. She raids the public library for books on method acting and getting into character. He falls back on stoicism. I'll be lucky to memorize all the lines. After 2 weeks, he's almost competent. After 3, something more starts to happen. No fair, she says. Have you been practicing? He has been, in ways he just now discovers. He never realized it before, but the law itself is theater. Long before you take anyone to court. Ray has one gift, to play himself with a fearsome intensity. This will make him, over the coming years, a highly successful litigator of copyright and patent. Now, that simple gift turns his Macduff weirdly hypnotic. By standing still in deadpan earnestness, he seems to tap into the planetary will. Dorothy's main superpower, in place since girlhood, is being able to read every muscle around a person's mouth and eyes and tell with perfect accuracy whether he's lying. This does nothing for her stenography or her Lady Macbeth, but it does make her want to test the outer limits of this man's innocence. 3 nights a week of rehearsals for 5 weeks, and she's convinced. Ray Brinkman would indeed leave his wife and kids alone and unprotected out in a castle in the Styx just to save his godforsaken country. The staging is very 70s, very Watergate. Admission is free, and the community gets its money's worth. For 3 nights running, Lady Macbeth goes down in spectacular flames. For 3 nights running, Macduff and his men, kitted out as trees, help the forest migrate from Birnam Wood all the way to Dunsinane. Trees actually journey across the stage. Oak, hearts of oak, armies and navies of oak, post and lintel of the House of History. The men hold great branches, and while unwitting Macbeth declares his prophecy-ensured safety, his attackers dance so slowly across the boards they seem not to move at all. And each night, Ray has almost forever to think, something is happening to me. Something heavy, huge, and slow coming from far outside that I do not understand. He has no idea. The thing that comes for him is a genus more than 600 species strong, familiar, protean, setting up camp from the tropics all the way up through the temperate north, the generalist emblem of all trees. Thick, clotted, craggy, but solid on the earth and covered in other living things. 300 years growing, 300 years holding, 300 years dying. Oak. The oaks swear him in as temporary deputy in their fight against the human monster. Good Macduff hides behind their cut branches. Many living things were harmed in the making of this production. Hoping he'll remember his next lines, praying he'll defeat the usurper again tonight, and marveling at the strange, irregular, lobed shapes fleshing out his camouflage like the letters of an alphabet from outer space, each glyph shaped by something that looks for all the world like deliberation. He can't read the text on his banner. It's written by a thing with 500 million root tips. It says, oak and door come from the same ancient word. After the closing night party, Ray and Dorothy end up in bed. Theater and Dorothy's whim have held them in suspended thrall for that long. Then, a cliff dive for him, after all. It's dark enough to hush the worst of their many inner sirens and alarms. But 6 inches from his candle-lit face, she can still make out the smallest muscles around his eyes. How do you feel about your parents? Have you ever had racist thoughts? Did you ever shoplift? Am I on trial? Why are you torturing me? No reason. Her whole face twitches like a Mexican jumping bean. He rolls onto his back and looks up to the ceiling. I've never been on stage like that before. It makes you feel like you're talking to the gods. Doesn't it just? And then, do you think we're going somewhere? She scrambles up on her elbow to find his face. We? You mean like humanity? Sure, but you and me first. Then everybody. I don't know. How the hell should I know? He hears her anger and thinks he understands. His hand pats about on the sheets, feeling for hers. I feel like this was supposed to happen. This?
Merciless Lady M, mocking. Destiny, you mean?
It's like he's frozen floating across the stage in time-lapse again, disguised as Burnham Wood.
I earn a good salary. I'll be all paid up on my loans in 5 more years. They'll make me a partner before you know it.
Her eyes squeeze shut. In a few years, the bombs will be falling, the Earth will be spent, and the only humans left will be fleeing the planet in rockets to nowhere.
You wouldn't have to work if you didn't want to.
She sits up. Her hand presses down on his sternum, pinning him.
Hang on! Oh, God! Are you proposing?
He cocks his head and dares her.
Heart of oak.
Because we slept together?
Once?
She doesn't need her special gift to see how badly the mockery stings him.
Wait! Am I your first?
He holds still, frozen, halfway across the stage.
Maybe you should have asked me that 2 hours ago.
Look, I mean, marriage? The mere word in her mouth turns baroque and alien.
I can't get married. I'm supposed to, I don't know, go backpacking in South America for 2 years, move to the village and take drugs, get involved with a light plane pilot who moonlights for the CIA.
I have a backpack. They have patent lawyers in New York.
I'm not sure about the pilot part.
She's ambushed and laughing and shaking her head.
You're joking! You're not joking! What the hell?
She does a back dive onto the pillows.
What the hell, I say? Lead on, Macduff!
They have each other again. This time, it's binding. In the stillness of afterward, she can feel the wet on his temple.
Is something wrong?
Nothing.
I don't scare the crap out of you?
No.
You're lying to me. First time.
Perhaps.
But you love me.
Perhaps.
Perhaps? What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Something huge and heavy and slow and far away and altogether unknown to him begins to say what it might mean. And then he proceeds to show her.
Ray's prediction comes true. It takes just 5 years to pay off all his debts. He makes partner soon after. He's brilliant at what he does, nailing intellectual property thieves and getting them to cease and desist or pay up. His earnestness is hypnotic, his commitment to fairness and stability.
You're profiting from something that belongs to someone else. The world can't work that way.
Almost always, the other side settles out of court. Dorothy's prediction, for her part, is not exactly wrong. The bombs are indeed falling, but mid-sized bombs, all over the globe, small enough that nobody has to flee the planet, just yet. She, for one, keeps the day job, transcribing the words of people under oath as fast as they can speak. The secret is not to care what the words mean. Paying attention decimates your speed. 6 years pass as if a single season. They break up. They get re-engaged while playing the romantic leads in an alter-ego community theater production of You Can't Take It With You. Her feet go stone cold again. They recommit after walking 500 miles of the Appalachian Trail together in 28 days. Then again by hand signals while skydiving. Their average run is 5 months. The fourth time she breaks things off, it's so traumatic she quits her job and disappears for weeks. Her friends won't tell Ray anything. He begs them for news, a phone number, anything. He tasks them with long letters, which they say they can't deliver. Then a note from her,
neither apologizing nor cruel. She won't say where she is. She simply lays out the deathly claustrophobia, the killing panic she feels at signing a legally binding document determining the bearing and conduct of the rest of her life. I want to be with you. You know that. That's why I keep saying yes. But a legal business deal? Rights and ownership? Oh, Ray, if only you were a discredited doctor or a bankrupt businessman, a shyster real estate agent, anything but a property lawyer. He writes to the return address, a post office box in Eau Claire. He tells her that slavery is outlawed everywhere in the world. She'll never be anyone's property. He won't change his career for her. Copyright and patent law is what he knows. It's necessary work, the engine of the world's wealth, and he's good at it. Maybe better than good. But if he must choose between giving up the idea of marriage or giving up the idea of acting in another amateur theatrical production with her, well, nolo contendere. Just come back, and we'll live together in sin with two separate cars, two separate bank accounts, two separate houses, two separate wills. Shortly after he mails the letter, she shows up on the doorstep of his bungalow, late at night, with two tickets to Rome. It raises some questions at his office, but he leaves with her on a non-honeymoon 2 days later. On the third night in the Eternal City, with the Prosecco flowing freely and all the pretty lights and the crumbling antiquities and the damn street music and the lime trees with their glorious crowns and white lights strung all through their graceful boughs, she asks him, "What the hell? Hey, Ray?" If he will be her lawfully acquired chattel, contractually bound to her forever. They end up chucking coins over their left shoulders into the Trevi Fountain. Not an original idea, and they probably owe someone royalties. They make it back to St. Paul in time for Oktoberfest. They swear to each other never to tell anyone, to deny everything. But their friends guess the moment the couple steps out smirking in public together. "What happened to you two in Rome?"
"Nothing special."
No one needs any superpower in reading facial muscles to know they're lying through their teeth. "Did you get thrown in jail or something? Did you get married? You two got married, didn't you? You're married!" And it makes no earthly difference in the world. Dorothy moves back in. She insists on scrupulous bookkeeping, splitting every shared expense down the exact middle. But something in the back of her brain thinks, as she drifts through his lovely library and dining room and sunroom, "When it happens, when it's time to brood, when I turn all weird and hot to propagate, then all of this will belong to my babies." On their first anniversary, he writes her a letter. He puts some time into the wording. He can't possibly speak the words, so he leaves them on the breakfast table when he goes to work. "You have given me a thing I could never have imagined before I knew you. It's like I had the word book, and you put one in my hands. I had the word game, and you taught me how to play. I had the word life, and then you came along and said, 'Oh, you mean this?'" He says there's nothing on earth he can give to her for their anniversary to thank her for what she has given him. Nothing except for a thing that grows. "Here's what I propose we do." He doesn't know where he gets the idea. He has forgotten the slow, heavy, outside prophecies that came over him on his first amateur theatrical outing, when he had to play a man who had to play a tree. Dorothy reads the words while driving herself to the courthouse for an afternoon of transcribing hearings. "Every year, as close to this day as we can, Let's go to the nursery and find something for the yard. I don't know anything about plants. I don't know their names or how to care for them. I don't even know how to tell one blurry green thing from another. But I can learn, as I've had to relearn everything, myself, my likes and dislikes, the width and height and depth of where I live, again, alongside you. Not everything we plant will take. Not every plant will thrive. But together, we can watch the ones that do fill up our garden. As she reads, her eyes cloud, and she drives up onto the curb and wraps the car around a parkway linden wide enough to destroy her front grill. Now, the linden, it turns out, is a radical tree, as different from an oak as a woman is from a man. It's the bee tree, the tree of peace, whose tonics and teas can cure every kind of tension and anxiety, a tree that cannot be mistaken for any other, for alone in all the catalog of 100,000 earthly species, its flowers and tiny hard fruit hang down from surfboard bracts whose sole perverse purpose seems to be to state its own singularity. The lindens will come for her, starting with this ambush. But the full adoption will take years. She requires 11 stitches to close the gash above her right eye, where the steering wheel cut her open. Ray rushes from his office to the hospital. In his panic, he crunches the rear right bumper of a doctor's BMW in the hospital parking garage. He's in tears when they lead him into surgery. She's sitting up in a chair with bandages wrapped around her head, trying to read things. Everything is double. The brand name on the gauze wrappings looks to her like Johnson and Johnson and Johnson and Johnson. Her eyes light up to see him, both of him.
Ray, Ray, honey, what's wrong?
He rushes to her, and she recoils in confusion. Then she gets it.
Hush, it's okay. I'm not going anywhere. Let's plant something.